people at the picnic table. Keep it small, he told himself. Easy. Little taps. Don't go starting any echoes. The object is not to hurt these people. The young woman grabbed her baby from its carrier seat rudely, waking it. It began to cry. Don't come near me, you crazy person, she said. Andy looked at the man and his wife. None of this is very important, he said, and pushed. Fresh pain settled over the back of his head like a spider and sank in. The young man looked relieved. Well, thank God. His wife offered a tentative smile. The push hadn't taken so well with her. Her maternity had been aroused. Lovely baby you have there, Andy said. Little boy, isn't it? The blind man stepped off the curbing, pitched forward, and struck his head on the doorpost of the red Pinto that probably belonged to the two girls. He howled. Blood flowed from his temple. I'm blind! He screamed again. The young woman's tentative smile became radiant. Yes, a boy, she said. His name is Michael. Hi, Mike, Andy said. He ruffled the baby's mostly bald head. I can't think why he's crying, the young woman said. He was sleeping so well until just now. He must be hungry. Sure, that's it, her husband said. Excuse me. Andy walked toward the information booth. There was no time to lose now. Someone else could turn into this roadside bedlam at any time. What is it, man? The fellow in blue jeans asked. Is it a bust? Nah, nothing happened, Andy said, and gave another light push. It was starting to make him feel sick now. His head thudded and pounded. Oh, the fellow said. Well, I was just trying to figure out how to get to Chagrin Falls from here. Excuse me. And he sauntered back inside the information booth. The two girls had retreated to the security fence that separated the turnout from the private farmland beyond it. They stared at him with wide eyes. The blind man was now shuffling around on the pavement in a circle with his arms held stiffly out in front of him. He was cursing and weeping. Andy advanced slowly toward the girls, holding his hands out to show them there was nothing in them. He spoke to them. One of them asked him a question, and he spoke again. Surely they both began to smile relieved smiles and to nod. Andy waved to them, and they both waved in return. Then he walked rapidly across the grass toward the station wagon. His forehead was beaded with cold sweat, and his stomach was rolling greasily. He could only pray that no one would drive in before he and Charlie got away, because there was nothing left. He was completely tipped over. He slid in behind the wheel and keyed the engine. Daddy, Charlie said, and threw herself at him, buried her face against his chest. He hugged her briefly and then backed out of the parking slot. Turning his head was agony. The black horse. In the aftermath, that was the thought that always came to him. He had let the black horse out of its stall somewhere in the dark barn of his subconscious, and now it would again batter its way up and down through his brain. He would have to get them someplace and lay up. Quick. He wasn't going to be capable of driving for long. The black horse, he said thickly. It was coming. No, it wasn't coming. It was here. Thud. 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 Yes, it was here. It was free. Daddy, look out! Charlie screamed. The blind man had staggered directly across their path. Andy braked. The blind man began to pound on the hood of the wagon and scream for help. To their right, the young mother had begun to breastfeed her baby. Her husband was reading a paperback. The man from the information booth had gone over to talk to the two girls from the Red Pinto, perhaps hoping for some quickie experience kinky enough to write up for the penthouse forum. Sprawled out on the pavement, Baldy slept on. The other operative pounded on the hood of the wagon again and again. Help me! He screamed. I'm blind! Dirty bastard did something to my eyes! I'm blind! Daddy, Charlie moaned. For a crazy instant, he almost floored the accelerator. Inside his aching head, he could hear the sound the tires would make, could feel the dull thudding of the wheels as they passed over the body. He had kidnapped Charlie and held a gun to her head. Perhaps he had been the one who had stuffed the rag into Vicky's mouth so she wouldn't scream when they pulled out her fingernails. It would be so very good to kill him. Except then what would separate him from them? He laid on the horn instead. It sent another bright spear of agony through his head. The blind man leaped away from the car as if stung. Andy hauled the wheel around and drove past him. The last thing he saw in the rearview mirror as he drove down the re-entry lane was the blind man sitting on the pavement, his face twisted in anger and terror. and the young woman placidly raising baby Michael to her shoulder to burp him. He entered the flow of turnpike traffic without looking. A horn blared, tires squalled, a big Lincoln swerved around the wagon, and the driver shook his fist at them. "Daddy, are you okay?" "I will be," he said. His voice seemed to come from far away. "Charlie, look at the toll ticket and see what the next exit is." The traffic blurred in front of his eyes. It doubled, trebled, came back together, then drifted into prismatic fragments again, sun reflecting off bright chrome everywhere. "And fasten your seatbelt, Charlie." The next exit was Hammersmith, 20 miles farther up. Somehow he made it. He thought later that it was only the consciousness of Charlie sitting next to him, depending on him, that kept him on the road. Just as Charlie had got him through all the things that came after, the knowledge of Charlie needing him. Charlie McGee, whose parents had once needed $200. There was a Best Western at the foot of the Hammersmith ramp, and Andy managed to get them checked in, specifying a room away from the turnpike. He used a bogus name. "They'll be after us, Charlie," he said. "I need to sleep, but only until dark. That's all the time we can take, all we dare to take. Wake me up when it's dark." She said something else, but then he was falling on the bed. The world was blurring down to a gray point, and then even the point was gone, and everything was darkness where the pain couldn't reach. There was no pain, and there were no dreams. When Charlie shook him awake again on that hot August evening at 7:15, the room was stifling hot, and his clothes were soaked with sweat. She had tried to make the air conditioner work, but hadn't been able to figure out the controls. "It's okay," he said. He swung his feet onto the floor and put his hands on his temples, squeezing his head so it wouldn't blow up. "Is it any better, Daddy?" she asked anxiously. "A little," he said. And it was, but only a little. "We'll stop in a little while and get some chow. That'll help some more. Where are we going?" He shook his head slowly back and forth. He had only the money he had left the house with that morning, about $17. He had his master charge and Visa, but he paid for their room with the 220s he always kept in the back of his wallet. "My run-out money," he sometimes told Vicky, joking, but how hellishly true that had turned out to be, rather than use either one of them. Using either of those cards would be like painting a sign, "This way to the fugitive college instructor and his daughter." The $17 would buy them some burgers and top off the wagon's gas tank once. Then they would be stone broke. "I don't know, Charlie," he said, "just away. When are we going to get Mommy?" Andy looked up at her, and his headache started to get worse again. He thought of the drops of blood on the floor and on the washing machine porthole. He thought of the smell of pledge. "Charlie," he said, and could say no more. There was no need anyway. She looked at him with slowly widening eyes. Her hand drifted up to her trembling mouth. "Oh, no, Daddy, please say it's no." "Charlie," she screamed. "Oh, please say it's no." "Charlie, those people who..." "Please say she's all right. Say she's all right. Say she's all right." The room was so hot. The air conditioning was off. That was all it was, but it was so hot. His head aching, the sweat rolling down his face. Not cold sweat now, but hot, like oil, hot. "No," Charlie was saying. "No, no, 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 no." She shook her head. Her pigtails flew back and forth, making him think absurdly of the first time he and Vicky had taken her to the amusement park, the carousel. It wasn't the lack of air conditioning. "Charlie," he yelled, "Charlie, the bathtub, the water." She screamed. She turned her head toward the open bathroom door, and there was a sudden blue flash in there like a light bulb burning out. The shower head fell off the wall and clattered into the tub, twisted and black. Several of the blue tiles shattered to fragments. He barely caught her when she fell, sobbing. "Daddy, I'm sorry. I'm sorry." "It's all right," he said shakily, and enfolded her. From the bathroom, thin smoke drifted out of the fused tub. All the porcelain surfaces had crack-glazed instantly. It was as if the entire bathroom had been run through some powerful but defective firing kiln. The towels were smoldering. "It's all right," he said, holding her, rocking her. "Charlie, it's all right. It's going to be all right. Somehow it'll come right, I promise." "I want Mommy," she sobbed. He nodded. He wanted her, too. He held Charlie tightly to him and smelled ozone and porcelain and cooked Best Western towels. She had almost flash-fried them both. "It's going to be all right," he told her, and rocked her. Not really believing it, but it was the litany, it was the psalter, the voice of the adult calling down the black well of years into the miserable pit of terrorized childhood. It was what you said when things went wrong. It was the nightlight that could not banish the monster from the closet, but perhaps only keep it at bay for a little while. It was the voice without power that must speak nevertheless. "It's going to be all right," he told her, not really believing it, knowing as every adult knows in his secret heart that nothing is really all right, ever. "It's going to be all right." He was crying. He couldn't help it now. His tears came in a flood, and he held her to his chest as tightly as he could. "Charlie, I swear to you, somehow it's going to be all right."
Five.
The one thing they had not been able to hang around his neck, as much as they might have liked to, was the murder of Vicky. Instead, they had elected to simply erase what had happened in the laundry room. Less trouble for them. Sometimes, not often, Andy wondered what their neighbors back in Lakeland might have speculated. Bill collectors? Marital problems? Maybe a drug habit or an incident of child abuse? They hadn't known anyone on Conifer Place well enough for it to have been any more than idle dinner table chat, a 9 days wonder soon forgotten when the bank that held their mortgage released their house. Sitting on the deck now and looking out into the darkness, Andy thought he might have had more luck that day than he had known or been able to appreciate. He had arrived too late to save Vicky, but he had left before the removal people arrived. There had never been a thing about it in the paper, not even a squib about how, funny thing, an English instructor named Andrew McGee and his family had just up and disappeared. Perhaps the shop had got that quashed, too. Surely he had been reported missing. One or all of the guys he had been eating lunch with that day would have done that much, but it hadn't made the papers. And, of course, bill collectors don't advertise. "They would have hung it on me if they could," he said, unaware that he had spoken aloud. But they couldn't have. The medical examiner could have fixed the time of death, and Andy, who had been in plain sight of some disinterested third party, and in the case of E.H. 116, style in the short story, from 10 to 11:30, 25 disinterested third parties, all that day, could not have been set up to take the fall. Even if he'd been unable to provide substantiation for his movements during the critical time, there was no motive. So the two of them had killed Vicky and then gone herring off after Charlie, but not without notifying what Andy thought of as the removal people. And in his mind's eye, he even saw them that way, smooth-faced young men dressed in white coveralls. And sometime after he had gone herring off after Charlie, maybe as short a time as 5 minutes, but almost surely no longer than an hour, the removal people would have rolled up to his door. While Conifer Place dozed the afternoon away, Vicky had been removed. They might even have reasoned, correctly, that a missing wife would have been more of a problem for Andy than a provably dead one. No body, no estimated time of death. No estimated time of death, no alibi. He would be watched, cosseted, politely tied down. Of course, they would have put Charlie's description out on the wire. Vicky's, too, for that matter. But Andy would not have been free to simply go tearing off on his own. So she had been removed, and now he didn't even know where she was buried. Or maybe she'd been cremated, or... Oh, shit, why are you doing this to yourself? He stood up abruptly and poured the remainder of Grantham's mule kick over the deck railing. It was all in the past. None of it could be changed. It was time to stop thinking about it. A neat trick, if you could do it. He looked up at the dark shapes of the trees and squeezed the glass tightly in his right hand, and the thought crossed his mind again. "Charlie, I swear to you, somehow, it's gonna be all right."
6.
That winter in Tashmore, so long after his miserable awakening in that Ohio motel, it seemed his desperate prediction had finally come true. It was not an idyllic winter for them. Not long after Christmas, Charlie caught a cold and snuffled and coughed her way through to early April, when it finally cleared up for good. For a while, she ran a fever. Andy fed her aspirin halves and told himself that if the fever did not go down in 3 days' time, he would have to take her to the doctor across the lake in Bradford, no matter what the consequences. But her fever did go down, and for the rest of the winter, Charlie's cold was only a constant annoyance to her. Andy managed to get himself a minor case of frostbite on one memorable occasion in March, and nearly managed to burn them both up one screaming sub-zero night in February by overloading the wood stove. Ironically, it was Charlie who woke up in the middle of the night and discovered the cottage was much too hot. On December 14th, they celebrated his birthday, and on March 24th, they celebrated Charlie's. She was 8, and sometimes Andy looked at her with a kind of wonder, as if catching sight of her for the first time. She was not a little girl anymore. She stood to past his elbow. Her hair had got long again, and she had taken to braiding it to keep it out of her eyes. She was going to be beautiful. She already was, red nose and all. They were without a car. Irv Mander's Willys had frozen solid in January, and Andy thought the block was cracked. He'd started it every day, more from a sense of responsibility than anything else, because not even four-wheel drive would have pulled them out of Granther's camp after the New Year. The snow, undisturbed except for the tracks of squirrels, chipmunks, a few deer, and a persistent raccoon that came around to sniff hopefully at the garbage hold, was almost 2 feet deep by then. There were old-fashioned cross-country skis in the small shed behind the cottage, 3 pairs of them, but none that would fit Charlie. It was just as well. Andy kept her indoors as much as possible. They could live with her cold, but he didn't want to risk a return of the fever. He found an old pair of Granther's ski boots, dusty and cracked with age, tucked away in a cardboard toilet tissue box under the table where the old man had once planed shutters and made doors. Andy oiled them, flexed them, and then found he still could not fill Granther's shoes without stuffing the toes full of newspaper. There was something funny about that, but he also found it a touch ominous. He thought about Granther a lot that long winter, and wondered what he would have made of their predicament. Half a dozen times that winter he hooked up the cross-country skis. No modern snap bindings here, only a confusing and irritating tangle of straps, buckles, and rings, and worked his way across the wide, frozen expanse of Tashmore Pond to the Bradford Town Landing. From there, a small, winding road led into the village, tucked neatly away in the hills 2 miles east of the lake. He always left before first light, with Granther's knapsack on his back, and never arrived back before 3 in the afternoon. On one occasion he barely beat a howling snowstorm that would have left him blinded and directionless and wandering on the ice. Charlie cried with relief when he came in, and then went into a long, alarming coughing fit. The trips to Bradford were for supplies and clothes for him and Charlie. He had Granther's Strutton money, and later on he broke into 3 of the larger camps at the far end of Tashmore Pond and stole money. He was not proud of this, but it seemed to him a matter of survival. The camps he chose might have sold on the real estate market for $80,000 apiece, and he supposed the owners could afford to lose their $30 or $40 worth of cookie jar money, which was exactly where most of them kept it. The only other thing he touched that winter was the large range oil drum behind a large modern cottage, quaintly named Camp Confusion. From this drum, he took about 40 gallons of oil. He didn't like going to Bradford. He didn't like the certain knowledge that the oldsters who sat around the big pot-bellied stove down by the cash register were talking about the stranger who was staying across the lake in one of the camps. Stories had a way of getting around, and sometimes they got into the wrong ears. It wouldn't take much, only a whisper, for the shop to make an inevitable connection between Andy, his grandfather, and his grandfather's cottage in Tashmore, Vermont. But he simply didn't know what else to do. They had to eat, and they couldn't spend the entire winter living on canned sardines. He wanted fresh fruit for Charlie, and vitamin pills, and clothes. Charlie had arrived with nothing to her name but a dirty blouse, a pair of red pants, and a single pair of underdrawers. There was no cough medicine that he trusted, there were no fresh vegetables, and, crazily enough, hardly any matches. Every camp he broke into had a fireplace, but he found only a single box of diamond wooden matches. He could have gone farther afield. There were other camps and cottages, but many of the other areas were plowed out and patrolled by the Tashmore Constabulary, and on many of the roads there were at least 1 or 2 year-round residents. In the Bradford General Store, he was able to buy all the things he needed, including 3 pairs of heavy pants and 3 woolen shirts that were approximately Charlie's size. There were no girls' underwear, and she had to make do with size 8 jockey shorts. This disgusted and amused Charlie by turns. Making the 6-mile round trip across to Bradford on Grandpa's skis was both a burden and a pleasure to Andy. He didn't like leaving Charlie alone, not because he didn't trust her, but because he always lived with the fear of coming back and finding her gone or dead. The old boots gave him blisters no matter how many pairs of socks he put on. If he tried to move too fast, he gave himself headaches, and then he would remember the small numb places on his face and envision his brain as an old bald tire, a tire that had been used so long and hard that it was down to the canvas in places. If he had a stroke in the middle of this damned lake and froze to death, what would happen to Charlie then? But he did his best thinking on these trips. The silence had a way of clearing his head. Tashmore Pond itself was not wide. Andy's path across it from the west bank to the east was less than a mile, but it was very long. With the snow lying 4 feet deep over the ice by February, he sometimes paused halfway across and looked slowly to his right and left. The lake then appeared to be a long corridor floored with dazzling white tile, clean, unbroken, stretching out of sight in either direction. Sugar-dusted pines bordered it all around. Above was the hard, dazzling, and merciless blue sky of winter, or the low and featureless white of coming snow. There might be the far-off call of a crow or the low rippling thud of the ice stretching, but that was all. The exercise toned up his body. He grew a warm singlet of sweat between his skin and his clothes, and it felt good to work up a sweat and then wipe it off your brow. He had somehow forgotten that feeling while teaching Yeats and Williams and correcting blue books. In this silence and through the exertion of working his body hard, his thoughts came clear, and he worked the problem over in his mind. Something had to be done. Should have been done long since, but that was in the past. They had come to Grantham's place for the winter, but they were still running. The uneasy way he felt about the old-timers sitting around the stove with their pipes and their inquisitive eyes was enough to ram that fact home. He and Charlie were in a corner, and there had to be some way out of it. And he was still angry because it wasn't right. They had no right. His family were American citizens living in a supposedly open society, and his wife had been murdered, his daughter kidnapped, the two of them hunted like rabbits in a hedgerow. He thought again that if he could get the story across to someone, or to several someones, the whole thing could be blown out of the water. He hadn't done it before because that odd hypnosis, the same sort of hypnosis that had resulted in Vicky's death, had continued, at least to some degree. He hadn't wanted his daughter growing up like a freak in a sideshow. He hadn't wanted her institutionalized, not for the good of the country and not for her own good. And worst of all, he had continued to lie to himself. Even after he had seen his wife crammed into the ironing closet in the laundry with that rag in her mouth, he had continued to lie to himself and tell himself that sooner or later they would be left alone. "Just playing for funsies," they had said as kids. "Everybody has to give back the money at the end." Except they weren't kids. They weren't playing for funsies, and nobody was going to give him and Charlie anything back when the game was over. This game was for keeps. In silence, he began to understand certain hard truths. In a way, Charlie was a freak, not much different from the thalidomide babies of the 60s or those girl children of mothers who had taken DES. The doctors just hadn't known that those girl children were going to develop vaginal tumors and abnormal numbers 14 or 16 years down the road. It was not Charlie's fault, but that did not change the fact. Her strangeness, her freakishness, was simply on the inside. What she had done at the Manders farm had been terrifying, totally terrifying, and since then Andy had found himself wondering just how far her ability reached, how far it could reach. He had read a lot of the literature of parapsychology during their year on the Dodge, enough to know that both pyrokinesis and telekinesis were suspected to be tied in with certain poorly understood ductless glands. His reading had also told him that the two talents were closely related, and that most documented cases centered around girls not a whole lot older than Charlie was right now. She had been able to initiate that destruction at the Manders farm at the age of 7. Now she was nearly 8. What might happen when she turned 12 and entered adolescence? Maybe nothing, maybe a great deal. She said she wasn't going to use the power anymore, but if she was forced to use it, what if it began to come out spontaneously? What if she began to light fires in her sleep as a part of her own strange puberty, a fiery counterpart of the nocturnal seminal emissions most teenage boys experienced? What if the shop finally decided to call off its dogs, and Charlie was kidnapped by some foreign power? Questions, questions. On his trips across the pond, Andy tried to grapple with them and came reluctantly to believe that Charlie might have to submit to some sort of custody for the rest of her life, if only for her own protection. It might be as necessary for her as the cruel leg braces were for the victims of muscular dystrophy, or the strange prosthetics for the thalidomide babies. And then there was the question of his own future. He remembered the numb places, the bloodshot eye. No man wants to believe that his own death warrant has been signed and dated, and Andy did not completely believe that, but he was aware that two or three more hard pushes might kill him, and he realized that his normal life expectancy might already have been considerably shortened. Some provision had to be made for Charlie in case that happened, but not the shop's way, not the small room. He would not allow that to happen. So he thought it over, and at last he came to a painful decision. Seven. Andy wrote six letters. They were almost identical. Two were to Ohio's United States senators. One was to the woman who represented the district of which Harrison was a part in the U.S. House of Representatives. One was to the New York Times. One was to the Chicago Tribune. And one was to the Toledo Blade. All six letters told the story of what had happened, beginning with the experiment in Jason Gearney Hall, and ending with his and Charlie's enforced isolation on Tashmore Pond. When he had finished, he gave one of the letters to Charlie to read. She went through it slowly and carefully, taking almost an hour. It was the first time she had got the entire story from beginning to end. "You're going to mail these?" she asked when she finished. "Yes," he said. "Tomorrow, I think tomorrow will be the last time I dare go across the pond." It had at last begun to warm up a little. The ice was still solid, but it creaked constantly now, and he didn't know how much longer it would be safe. "What will happen, Daddy?" He shook his head. "I don't know for sure. All I can do is hope that once the story is out, those people who've been chasing us will have to give it up." Charlie nodded soberly. "You should have done it before." "Yes," he said, knowing that she was thinking of the near cataclysm at the Manders farm last October. "Maybe I should have, but I never had a chance to think much, Charlie. Keeping us going was all I had time to think about, and what thinking you do get a chance to do when you're on the run, well, mostly it's stupid thinking. I kept hoping they'd give up and leave us alone. That was a terrible mistake." "They won't make me go away, will they?" Charlie asked. "From you, I mean? We can stay together, can't we, Daddy?" "Yes," he said, not wanting to tell her that his conception of what might happen after the letters were mailed and received was probably as vague as hers. It was just after. "Then that's all I care about, and I'm not going to make any more fires." "All right," he said, and touched her hair. His throat was suddenly thick with the premonitory dread, and something that had happened near here suddenly occurred to him, something that he hadn't thought of for years. He had been out with his father and Granther had given Andy his .22, which he called his varmint rifle, when Andy clamored for it. Andy had seen a squirrel and wanted to shoot it. His dad had started to protest, and Granther had hushed him with an odd little smile. Andy had aimed the way Granther taught him. He squeezed the trigger rather than just jerking back on it, as Granther had also taught him, and he shot the squirrel. It tumbled off its limb like a stuffed toy, and Andy ran excitedly for it after handing the gun back to Granther. Up close, he had been struck dumb by what he saw. Up close, the squirrel was no stuffed toy. It wasn't dead. He had got it in the hindquarters, and it lay there dying in its own bright dapples of blood, its black eyes awake and alive and full of a horrible suffering. Its fleas, knowing the truth already, were trundling off the body in three busy little lines. His throat had closed with a snap, and at the age of 9, Andy tasted for the first time that bright, painty flavor of self-loathing. He stared numbly at his messy kill, aware that his father and grandfather were standing behind him, their shadows lying over him. 3 generations of McGee's standing over a murdered squirrel in the Vermont woods. And behind him, Granther said softly, "Well, you done it, Andy. How do you like it?" A
and the tears had come suddenly, overwhelming him, the hot tears of horror and realization, the realization that once it's done, it's done. He swore suddenly that he would never kill anything with a gun again. He swore it before God. "I'm not going to make any more fires," Charlie had said. And in his mind, Andy heard Grantha's reply to him on the day he had shot the squirrel, the day he had sworn to God he would never do anything like that again. "Never say that, Andy. God loves to make a man break a vow. It keeps him properly humble about his place in the world and his sense of self-control."
About what Irv Manders had said to Charlie. Charlie had found a complete set of Bomba the Jungle Boy books in the attic and was working her way slowly but surely through them. Now Andy looked at her, sitting in a dusty shaft of sunlight in the old black rocker, sitting just where his grandmother had always sat, usually with a basket of mending between her feet, and he struggled with an urge to tell her to take it back. To take it back while she still could, to tell her that she didn't understand the terrible temptation. If the gun was left there long enough, sooner or later you would pick it up again. God loves to make a man break a vow.
Eight.
No one saw Andy mail his letters except Charlie Payson, the fellow who had moved into Bradford in November and had since been trying to make a go of the old Bradford Notions and Novelty Shop. Payson was a small, sad-faced man who had tried to buy Andy a drink on one of his visits to town. In the town itself, the expectation was that if Payson didn't make it work during the coming summer, Notions and Novelties would have a for sale or lease sign back in the window by September 15th. He was a nice enough fellow, but he was having a hard scrabble. Bradford wasn't the town it used to be. Andy walked up the street. He had left his skis stuck in the snow at the head of the road leading down to the Bradford Town Landing and approached the general store. Inside, the oldsters watched him with mild interest. There had been a fair amount of talk about Andy that winter. The consensus about yonder man there was that he was on the run from something, a bankruptcy, maybe, or a divorce settlement, maybe an angry wife who had been cheated out of custody of the kid. The small clothes Andy had bought hadn't been lost on them. The consensus was also that he and the kid had maybe broken into one of the camps across the pond and were spending the winter there. Nobody brought this possibility up to Bradford's constable, a Johnny-come-lately who had lived in town for only 12 years and thought he owned the place. Yonder man came from across the lake, from Tashmore, from Vermont. None of the old-timers who sat around Jake Rowley's stove in the Bradford General Store had much liking for Vermont ways. Them with their income tax and their snooty bottle law and that fucking Russian laid up in his house like a czar, writing books no one could understand. Let Vermonters handle their own problems, was the unanimous, if unstated, view. "He won't be crossing the pond much longer," one of them said. He took another bite from his Milky Way bar and began to gum it. "Not unless he's got him a pair of water wings," another answered, and they all chuckled. "We won't be seeing him much longer," Jake said complacently as Andy approached the store. Andy was wearing Grantha's old coat and had a blue wool band pulled over his ears and some memory, perhaps a family resemblance going back to Grantha himself, danced fleetingly in Jake's mind and then blew away. "When the ice starts to go out, he'll just dry up and blow away, him and whoever he's keeping over there." Andy stopped outside, unslung his pack, and took out several letters. Then he came inside. The men foregathered there examined their nails, their watches, the old pearl Kineo stove itself. One of them took out a gigantic blue railroad bandana and hawked mightily into it. Andy glanced around. "Morning, gentlemen."
"Morning to you," Jake Rowley said. "Get you anything?"
"You sell stamps, don't you?"
"Oh, yes. Government trusts me that far.
I'd like 6 15s, please." Jake produced them, tearing them carefully from one of the sheets in his old black postage book.
"Something else for you today?"
Andy thought, then smiled. It was the 10th of March. Without answering Jake, he went to the card rack beside the coffee grinder and picked out a large, ornate birthday card. "To you, daughter, on your special day," it said. He brought it back and paid for it.
"Thanks," Jake said, and rang it up.
"Very welcome," Andy replied and went out. They watched him adjust his headband, then stamp his letters one by one. The breath smoked out of his nostrils. They watched him go around the building to where the postbox stood, but none of them sitting around the stove could have testified in court as to whether or not he mailed those letters. He came back into view, shouldering into his pack.
"Off he goes," one of the old-timers remarked.
Civil enough fella, Jake said, and that closed the subject. Talk turned to other matters. Charles Payson stood in the doorway of his store, which hadn't done $300 worth of custom all winter long, and watched Andy go. Payson could have testified that the letters had been mailed. He had stood right here and watched him drop them into the slot in a bunch. When Andy disappeared from sight, Payson went back inside and through the doorway behind the counter where he sold penny candy and bang caps and bubble gum and into the living quarters behind. His telephone had a scrambler device attached to it. Payson called Virginia for instructions. Nine. There was and is no post office in Bradford, New Hampshire, or in Tashmore, Vermont, for that matter. Both towns were too small. The nearest post office to Bradford was in Teller, New Hampshire. At 1:15 p.m. on that March 10th, the small postal truck from Teller pulled up in front of the general store, and the postman emptied the mail from the standing box around to the side where Jake had pumped Jenny gas until 1970. The deposited mail consisted of Andy's six letters and a postcard from Miss Shirley Devine, a 50-year-old maiden lady, to her sister in Tampa, Florida. Across the lake, Andy McGee was taking a nap, and Charlie McGee was building a snowman. The postman, Robert Everett, put the mail in a bag, swung the bag into the back of his blue and white truck, and then drove on to Williams, another small New Hampshire town in Teller's zip code area. Then he U-turned in the middle of what the Williams residents laughingly called Main Street, and started back to Teller, where all the mail would be sorted and sent on at about 3 o'clock that afternoon. 5 miles outside of town, a beige Chevrolet Caprice was parked across the road, blocking both of the narrow lanes. Everett parked by the snowbank and got out of his truck to see if he could help. Two men approached him from the car. They showed him their credentials and explained what they wanted. "No," Everett said. He tried on a laugh, and it came out sounding incredulous, as if someone had just told him they were going to open Tashmore Beach for swimming this very afternoon. "If you doubt we are who we say we are," one of them began. This was Orville Jameson, sometimes known as O.J., sometimes known as the Juice. He didn't mind dealing with this hick postman. He didn't mind anything as long as his orders didn't take him any closer than 3 miles to that hellish little girl. "No, it ain't that. It ain't that at all," Robert Everett said. He was scared, as scared as any man is when suddenly confronted with the force of the government, when gray enforcement bureaucracy suddenly takes on a real face, like something grim and solid swimming up out of a crystal ball. He was determined nonetheless. "But what I got here is the mail, the U.S. mail. You guys must understand that." "This is a matter of national security," O.J. said. After the fiasco in Hastings Glen, a protective cordon had been thrown around the Mander's place. The grounds and the remains of the house had got the fine-tooth comb treatment. As a result, O.J. had recovered the windsucker, which now rested comfortably against the left side of his chest. "You say so, but that ain't good enough," Everett said. O.J. unbuttoned his Carol Reed parka so that Robert Everett could see the windsucker. Everett's eyes widened, and O.J. smiled a little. "Now, you don't want me to pull this, do you?" Everett couldn't believe this was happening. He tried one last time. "Do you guys know the penalty for robbing the U.S. mail? They put you in Leavenworth, Kansas, for that." "You can clear it with your postmaster when you get back to Teller," the other man said, speaking for the first time. "Now let's quit this fucking around, okay? Give us the bag of out-of-town mail." Everett gave him the small sack of mail from Bradford and Williams. They opened it right there on the road and sorted through it impersonally. Robert Everett felt anger and a kind of sick shame. What they were doing wasn't right, not even if it was the secrets of the nuclear bomb in there. Opening the U.S. mail by the side of the road wasn't right. Ludicrously, he found himself feeling about the same way he would have felt if a strange man had come barging into his house and pulled off his wife's clothes. "You guys are going to hear about this," he said in a choked, scared voice. "You'll see." "Here they are," the other fellow said to O.J. He handed him six letters, all addressed in the same careful hand. Robert Everett recognized them well enough. They had come from the box at the Bradford General Store. O.J. put the letters in his pocket, and the two of them walked back to their Caprice, leaving the open bag of mail on the road. "You guys are going to hear about this," Everett cried in a shaking voice. Without looking back, O.J. said, "Speak to your postmaster before you speak to anyone else. If you want to keep your postal service pension, that is." They drove away. Everett watched them go, raging, scared, sick to his stomach. At last he picked up the mailbag and tossed it back into the truck.
"Robbed," he said, surprised to find he was near tears. "Robbed! I've been robbed! Oh, God damn it! I've been robbed!"
He drove back to Teller as fast as the slushy roads would allow. He spoke to his postmaster, as the man had suggested. The Teller postmaster was Bill Cobham, and Everett was in Cobham's office for better than an hour. At times their voices came through the office door, loud and angry. Cobham was 56. He had been with the Postal Service for 35 years, and he was badly scared. At last he succeeded in communicating his fright to Robert Everett as well, and Everett never said a word, not even to his wife, about the day he had been robbed on the Teller Road between Bradford and Williams. But he never forgot it, and he never completely lost that sense of anger and shame and disillusion.
10.
By 2:30, Charlie had finished her snowman, and Andy, a little rested from his nap, had got up. Orville Jameson and his new partner, George Sadaka, were on an airplane. 4 hours later, as Andy and Charlie were sitting down to a game of 500 rummy, the supper dishes washed and drying in the drainer, the letters were on Cap Hollister's desk.
1.
On March 24th, Charlie McGee's birthday, Cap Hollister sat behind his desk filled with a great and ill-defined unease. The reason for the unease was not ill-defined. He expected John Rainbird in not quite an hour, and that was too much like expecting the devil to turn up on the dime, so to speak, and at least the devil stuck to a bargain once it was struck, if you believed his press releases. But Cap had always felt there was something in John Rainbird's personality that was fundamentally ungovernable. When all was said and done, he was nothing more than a hitman, and hitmen always self-destruct sooner or later. Cap felt that when Rainbird went, it would be with his spectacular bang. Exactly how much did he know about the McGee operation? No more than he had to, surely, but it nagged at him. Not for the first time, he wondered if, after this McGee affair was over, it might not be wise to arrange an accident for the big Indian. In the memorable words of Cap's father, Rainbird was as crazy as a man eating rat turds and calling it caviar. He sighed. Outside, a cold rain flew against the windows, driven by a strong wind. His study, so bright and pleasant in summer, was now filled with shifting gray shadows. They were not kind to him as he sat there with the McGee file on its library trolley at his left hand. The winter had aged him. He was not the same jaunty man who had biked up to the front door on that day in October when the McGees had escaped again, leaving a firestorm behind. Lines on his face that had been barely noticeable then had now deepened into fissures. He had been forced into the humiliation of bifocals, old man's glasses, he thought them, and adjusting to them had left him feeling nauseated for the first 6 weeks he wore them. These were the small things, the outward symbols of the way things had gone so crazily, maddeningly wrong. These were the things he bitched about to himself because all of his training and upbringing had schooled him against bitching about the grave matters that lay so closely below the surface. As if that damned little girl were a personal jinx, the only two women he had cared deeply about since the death of his mother had both died of cancer this winter. His wife, Georgia, 3 days after Christmas, and his personal secretary, Rachel, only a little over a month ago. He had known Georgia was gravely ill, of course. A mastectomy 14 months before her death had slowed but not stopped the progress of the disease. Rachel's death had been a cruel surprise. Near the end, he could remember how unforgivable we sometimes seem in retrospect, joking that she needed fattening up and Rachel throwing the jokes right back at him. Now all he had left was the shop, and he might not have that much longer. An insidious sort of cancer had invaded Cap himself. What would you call it? Cancer of the confidence? Something like that. And in the upper echelons, that sort of disease was nearly always fatal. Nixon, Lance, Helms, all victims of cancer of the credibility. He opened the McGee file and took out the latest additions, the 6 letters Andy had mailed less than 2 weeks ago. He shuffled through them without reading them. They were all essentially the same letter, and he had the contents almost by heart. Below them were glossy photographs, some taken by Charles Payson, some taken by other agents on the Tashmore side of the pond. There were photos showing Andy walking up Bradford's Main Street, photos of Andy shopping in the general store and paying for his purchases, photos of Andy and Charlie standing by the boathouse at the camp, Irv Mander's Willie's a snow-covered hump in the background, a photo showing Charlie sliding down a hard and sparkling incline of snow crust on a flattened cardboard box, her hair flying out from beneath a knitted cap that was too large for her. In this photo, her father was standing behind her, mittened hands on hips, head thrown back, bellowing laughter. Cap had looked at this photo often and long and soberly, and was sometimes surprised by a trembling in his hands when he put it aside. He wanted them that badly. He got up and went to the window for a moment. No Rich McKeon cutting grass today. The alders were bare and skeletal, the duck pond between the two houses a slate-like bare expanse. There were dozens of important items on the shop's plate this early spring, a veritable smorgasbord, but for Cap, there was really only one, and that was the matter of Andy McGee and his daughter Charlene. The Manders fiasco had done a lot of damage. The shop had ridden that out, and so had he, but it had begun a critical groundswell that would break soon enough. The critical center of that groundswell was the way the McGees had been handled from the day Victoria McGee had been killed and the daughter lifted, however, briefly. A lot of the criticism had to do with the fact that a college instructor who had never even been in the army had been able to take his daughter away from two trained shop agents, leaving one of them mad and one in a coma that had lasted for 6 months. The latter agent was never going to be any good for anything again. If anyone spoke the word sleep within his earshot, he keeled over bonelessly and might stay out from 4 hours to an entire day. In a bizarre sort of way, it was funny. The other major criticism had to do with the fact that the McGees had managed to stay one step ahead for so long. It made the shop look bad. It made them all look dumb. But most of the criticism was reserved for the incident at the Manders farm itself, because that had damned near blown the entire agency out of the water. Cap knew that the whispering had begun. The whispering, the memos, maybe even the testimony at the ultra-secret congressional hearings. "We don't want him hanging on like Hoover. This Cuban business went entirely by the boards because he couldn't get his head out of that damn McGee file. Wife died very recently, you know. Great shame. Hit him hard. Whole McGee business, nothing but a catalog of ineptitude. Perhaps a younger man." But none of them understood what they were up against. They thought they did, but they didn't. Again and again he had seen the rejection of the simple fact that the little girl was pyrokinetic, a fire starter. Literally dozens of reports suggested that the fire at the Manders farm had been started by a gasoline spill, by the woman's breaking a kerosene lamp, by spontaneous fucking combustion, and God only knew what other nonsense. Some of those reports came from people who had been there. Standing at the window, Cap found himself perversely wishing that Wanless were here. Wanless had understood. He could have talked to Wanless about this dangerous blindness. He went back to the desk. There was no sense kidding himself. Once the undermining process began, there was no way to stop it. It really was like a cancer. You could retard its growth by calling in favors, and Cap had called in 10 years' worth just to keep himself in the saddle this last winter. You might even be able to force it into remission, but sooner or later, you were gone. He felt he had from now until July if he played the game by the rules, from now until maybe November if he decided to really dig in and get tough. That, however, might mean ripping the agency apart at the seams, and he didn't want to do that. He had no wish to destroy something he had invested half his life in, but he would if he had to. He was going to see this through to the end. The major factor that had allowed him to stay in control was the speed with which they had located the McGees again. Cap was glad to take credit for that, since it helped to prop up his position, but all it had really taken was computer time. They had been living with this business long enough to have time to plow the McGee field both wide and deep. Filed away in the computer were facts on more than 200 relatives and 400 friends all the way around the McGee-Tomlinson family tree. These friendships stretched all the way back to Vicky's best friend in the first grade, a girl named Kathy Smith, who was now Mrs. Frank Worthy of Cabral, California, and who had probably not spared a thought for Vicky Tomlinson in 20 years or more. The computer was given the last seen data and promptly spit out a list of probabilities. Heading the list was the name of Andy's deceased grandfather, who had owned a camp on Tashmore Pond in Vermont. Ownership had since passed to Andy. The McGees had vacationed there, and it was within reasonable striking distance of the Manders farm by way of the back roads. The computer felt that if Andy and Charlie were to make for any known place, it would be this place. Less than a week after they had moved into Granthers, Cap knew they were there. A loose cordon of agents was set up around the camp. Arrangements had been made for the purchase of notions and novelties in Bradford on the probability that whatever shopping they needed to do would be done in Bradford. Passive surveillance, nothing more. All the photographs had been taken with telephoto lenses under optimum conditions for concealment. Cap had no intention of risking another firestorm. They could have taken Andy quietly on any of his trips across the lake. They could have shot them both as easily as they had got the picture of Charlie sledding on the cardboard carton. But Cap wanted the girl, and he had now come to believe that if they were going to have any real control over her, they would need her father as well. After locating them again, the most important objective had been to make sure they kept quiet. Cap didn't need a computer to tell him that as Andy grew more frightened, the chances that he would seek outside help went up and up. Before the Manders affair, a press leak could have been handled or lived with. Afterward, press interference became a different ballgame altogether. Cap had nightmares just thinking about what would happen if the New York Times got a hold of such a thing. For a brief period during the confusion that had followed the firestorm, Andy could have got his letters out, but apparently the McGees had been living with their own confusion. Their golden chance to mail the letters or make some phone calls had passed unused, and very well mightn't have come to anything anyway. The woods were full of crackpots these days, and newspeople were as cynical as anyone else. Theirs had become a glamour occupation. They were more interested in what Margot and Beau and Suzanne and Cheryl were doing. It was safer. Now the two of them were in a box. Cap had had the entire winter to consider options. Even at his wife's funeral, he had been running through his options. Gradually, he had settled upon a plan of action, and now he was prepared to tip that plan into motion. Payson, their man in Bradford, said that the ice was getting ready to go out on Tashmore Pond, and McGee had finally mailed his letters. Already he would be getting impatient for a response, and perhaps beginning to suspect his letters had never arrived at their intended sources. They might be getting ready to move, and Cap liked them right where they were. Beneath the photos was a thick typed report, better than 300 pages, bound in a blue top-secret cover. 11 doctors and psychologists had put the combination report and prospectus together under the overall direction of Dr. Patrick Hochstetter, a clinical psychologist and psychotherapist. He was, in Cap's opinion, one of the 10 or 12 most astute minds at the shop's disposal. At the $800,000 it had cost the taxpayer to put the report together, he ought to have been. Thumbing through the report now, Cap wondered what Wanless, that old doomsayer, would have made. His own intuition that they needed Andy alive was confirmed in here. The postulate Hochstetter's crew had based their own chain of logic on was the idea that all the powers they were interested in were exercised voluntarily, having their first cause in the willingness of the possessor to use them. And the key word was will. The girl's powers, of which pyrokinesis was only the cornerstone, had a way of getting out of control, of jumping nimbly over the barriers of her will. But this study, which incorporated all the available information, indicated that it was the girl herself who elected whether or not to set things in motion, as she had done at the Manders farm when she realized that the shop agents were trying to kill her father. He riffled through the recap of the original Lot 6 experiment. All the graphs and computer readouts boiled down to the same thing. Will is the first cause. Using will as the basis for everything, Hochstetter and his colleagues had gone through an amazing catalog of drugs before deciding on Thorazine for Andy and a new drug called Orison for the girl. 70 pages of gobbledygook in the report came down to the fact that the drugs would make them feel high, dreamy, floaty. Neither of them would be able to exercise enough will to choose between chocolate milk and white, let alone enough to start fires or convince people they were blind or whatever. They could keep Andy McGee drugged constantly. They had no real use for him. Both the report and Cap's own intuition suggested that he was a dead end, a burned-out case. It was the girl who interested them. Give me 6 months, Cap thought, and we'll have enough. Just long enough to map the terrain inside that amazing little head. No House or Senate subcommittee would be able to resist the promise of chemically induced psi powers and the enormous implications it would have on the arms race if that little girl was even half of what Wanla suspected. And there were other possibilities. They were not in the blue-backed report because they were too explosive for even a top-secret heading. Hochstetter, who had become progressively more excited as the picture took shape before him and his committee of experts, had mentioned one of these possibilities to Cap only a week ago. "This Z-factor," Hochstetter said, "have you considered any of the ramifications if it turns out that the child isn't a mule but a genuine mutation?" Cap had, although he didn't tell Hochstetter that. It raised the interesting question of eugenics, the potentially explosive question of eugenics, with its lingering connotations of Nazism and super-races, all the things Americans had fought World War II to put an end to. But it was one thing to sink a philosophical well and produce a gusher of bullshit about usurping the power of God, and quite another to produce laboratory evidence that the offspring of Lot 6's parents might be human torches, levitators, tele or telem paths, or God only knew what else. Ideals were cheap things to hold as long as there were no solid arguments for their overthrow. If there were, what then? Human breeding farms? As crazy as it sounded, Cap could visualize it. It could be the key to everything, world peace or world domination. And when you got rid of the trick mirrors of rhetoric and bombast, weren't they really the same thing? It was a whole can of worms. The possibilities stretched a dozen years into the future. Cap knew the best he himself could realistically hope for was 6 months, but it might be enough to set policy, to survey the land on which the tracks would be laid and the railroad would run. It would be his legacy to the country and to the world. Measured against this, the lives of a runaway college instructor and his ragamuffin daughter were less than dust in the wind. The girl could not be tested and observed with any degree of validity if she was constantly drugged, but her father would be their hostage to fortune. And on the few occasions they wanted to run tests on him, the reverse would hold. It was a simple system of levers, and as Archimedes had observed, a lever long enough would move the world. The intercom buzzed. "John Rainbird is here," the new girl said. Her usual bland receptionist tone was threadbare enough to show the fear beneath. "On that one, I don't blame you, babe," Cat thought. "Send him in, please."
Two. Same old Rainbird. He came in slowly, dressed in a brown and balding leather jacket over a faded plaid shirt. Old and scuffed dingoes peeked out from beneath the cuffs of his faded straight-leg jeans. The top of his huge head seemed almost to brush the ceiling. The gored ruin of his empty eye socket made Cap shudder inwardly. "Cap," he said, and sat down. "I've been in the desert too long."
"I've heard about your Flagstaff house," Cap said, "and your shoe collection."
John Rainbird only stared at him unblinkingly with his good eye.
"How come I never see you in anything but those old shit kickers?" Cap asked.
Rainbird smiled thinly and said nothing. The old unease filled Cap, and he found himself wondering again how much Rainbird knew and why it bothered him so much.
"I have a job for you," he said.
"Good. Is it the one I want?"
Cap looked at him, surprised, considering, and then said, "I think it is."
"Then tell me, Cap."
Cap outlined the plan that would bring Andy and Charlie McGee to Longmont. It didn't take long.
"Can you use the gun?" he asked when he was finished.
"I can use any gun, and your plan is a good one. It will succeed."
"How nice of you to give it your stamp of approval," Cap said.
He tried for light irony and only succeeded in sounding petulant. God damn the man, anyway.
"And I will fire the gun," Rainbird said, "on one condition."
Cap stood up, planted his hands on his desk, which was littered with components about the McGee file, and leaned toward Rainbird.
"No," he said, "you don't make conditions with me."
"I do this time," Rainbird said.
"But you will find it an easy one to fulfill, I think.
No, Cap repeated.
Suddenly his heart was hammering in his chest, although with fear or anger he was not sure.
You misunderstand. I am in charge of this agency and this facility. I am your superior. I believe you spent enough time in the army to understand the concept of a superior officer.
Yes,